I'm Marcus Smith, and this is Constant Wonder. Hanging in the National Gallery of Ireland is a painting that depicts a middle-class woman seated at a table writing a letter. Her maid is standing just off to the side and behind her. And the painting is by Dutch artist Johannes Vermeer. It has a storied history, this painting does, and not only for reasons of its beauty, its composition, its cultural value, you know, all those things that art historians will tell you about when they go about the business of interpretation. You see, this painting's history also includes having been stolen twice for reasons that I would say hardly seem rational. The whole thing is very ironic at one level because it is, as I mentioned, it's a peaceful, quiet, domestic scene, a lady at home writing a letter. This is placid, harmless, gentle stuff. And the painting then is taken hostage by violent revolutionaries. There's the irony for me. It's nothing short of bizarre in my book. Well, today we're going to learn about this painting taken hostage, along actually with other priceless paintings that were seized at the same time. One painting by Goya, two by Gainsborough, three by Rubens. And all of this happened because of an ideology that captured the mind and heart of a wealthy heiress named Rose Dugdale. And to be honest about it, this entire course of events really has nothing to do with high art, with aesthetics. It seems to have been all about power, coercion, manipulation, political rebellion. Who was this Rose Dugdale? Why did she do what she did? Well, we're going to find out today. Anthony Amore is with us. He's an expert in security matters related to art and homeland security. He's director of security and chief investigator at the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum, where he oversees ongoing efforts to recover 13 works of art stolen there from that museum back in 1990, I understand. But the story of Rose Dugdale and her heist, well, that goes back to the 1970s. Anthony Amore is author of The Woman Who Stole Vermeer, The True Story of Rose Dugdale and the Rustboro House Heist. He is also author of two previous books, national bestsellers, Stealing Rembrandts and The Art of the Con. Anthony Amore, welcome to our program.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
You know, on this show, we have featured stories of other famous art thefts, including the Mona Lisa. That's a pretty well-known painting. And it seems to me, as I hear about these stories, that these thefts of fine art, they just don't really seem to be about money for the most part. Is that pretty common? Is that kind of, par for the course? It's not about money, is it?
Well, what's interesting is that the stories that you hear, such as the theft of the Mona Lisa, the one that I've written about here from the Rustboro House in Ireland, the ones that catch people's attention like this are not for money, and that's why they catch attention, because they're sort of the outliers. But one of the things you learn when you research the theft of masterpieces is that the vast majority of the times they are for money. The people who steal these paintings most of the time are your common criminals who steal everything. And they find that they can't monetize these masterpieces, so the theft ends in failure. However, once in a while, a great story comes along in which you find the outlier, and that's the tale of Rose Dugdale and the theft of Lady writing a letter with her maid.
Well, you've written a book now about this notorious heist, and you had a chance to at least approach or request an interview because this Rose Dugdale is alive, and she declined. Why do you suppose she wouldn't speak with you?
Well, as the book was in progress and in the planning stages, it looked like she was going to speak to me. But at the very last minute, I was dealing with her through a very trusted intermediary of hers. She declined. And my belief, and it was alluded to from her intermediary, is that what happened is a key player in Irish Republican history named Dolores Price, one of the famed Price sisters who underwent a hunger strike in, around the time of Rose Dugdale's theft, had given an interview. Dolores gave an interview for a documentarian under the condition that it wouldn't be released until she passed away. And then she suddenly passed away at a relatively young age in her early 60s. The interview led to new investigations against members of the IRA and alleged members of the IRA for some serious crimes. And as a result, Rose was told that she couldn't speak with me for fear of anything she might say could be used to hurt someone else prospectively. Of course, the book would not have done that, but I understand the trepidation.
Well, what you've just told me is basically that this political scenario that it all stems from is an ongoing concern, an ongoing issue. The stakes remain high for some people. And so you're catching this, even though the heist took place in the 70s, this story is still kind of fresh.
It's kind of fresh in a variety of ways. First of all, things related to the IRA, even in the 70s, could be connected to homicides, which would have no statute of limitations, but not this theft in particular. However, the entire story is, it really resonates for our current era because readers will find that the heroes and the anti-heroes in the book are women. And it really tells the story of a woman, Rose Dugdale, who in the 1970s was believed to have been under the influence of the men that she was attached to. But in retrospect and under close examination, we find that it was the men that were under her spell. And just the juxtaposition of the times, seeing that it was almost inconceivable in the 1970s to believe that a woman would be the criminal mastermind and the daring ne'er-do-well with these strong men following her. It's just an interesting look back at that era and a story for its times in 2020 and 2021.
Is there some sense of an incongruity in the fact that she comes from high society?
Absolutely. You said that well. Yes, and that was an interesting part of her life. She was what people would now describe as a one percenter. She grew up in extreme wealth on a beautiful rolling farm in Devon in Great Britain. Her father was very wealthy, as was her mother. She could have lived a life of absolute luxury, and that's what was expected of her. In fact, she was one of the last women, the last class of women in 1958 to be presented before Queen Elizabeth II as a debutante. After that year, it was discontinued. So she was definitely part of high society. The idea that she abandoned all that to live with the working class and to fight alongside them for a cause that wasn't her own makes it a really interesting story.
So where does she go actually to become involved with this working class? What's her point of exiting high society? What was the appeal? What was the draw? What was the magnet?
Well, it was a work in progress. So in order to undergo the presentation before the Queen, she didn't want to do it. So she made a deal with her parents. They would allow her to go to Oxford to study in return. And it sounds hard in the current age to think that a parent would have to grudgingly acquiesce for their daughter to go to Oxford, but that was the times. And she went to Oxford, then she came to the United States and went to a very liberal college here in Massachusetts called Mount Holyoke. But she still hadn't made a transition to anti-capitalism that we later see. 1968, though, she was a little older than the rest, but she went with a group of students to Cuba at the invitation of Castro to study the revolution and study Havana. And she went, and of course, Castro put them to work too. And she was really moved by what she saw, much more than her fellow travelers. And she came home and in Great Britain decided to take on the cause of the working class and opened what was called a tenants union, which she would fight for people's rights to housing, for their rights from the government in terms of money from the dole and such. She was really a virulent fighter and scared civil servants when she would come to their offices to demand benefits. And along this way, she met a man named Walter Heaton, who was a union leader and a real rabble-rouser, a type of guy who led protests and strikes and such. And the two of them paired up to eventually adopt the cause of Irish republicanism to the extent that they even ran guns to the IRA.
Yeah, this is a strange thing that she would, I mean, of all the causes, having been in Cuba, I mean, I guess you can just pick your venue, but hopping over the Irish Sea wasn't too hard for her, I guess. It was right there.
It wasn't, and you're right. And but you make a good point that it does seem a bit incongruous because, you know, she had this tenants union, her storefront, her office front had a large tricolor of Ireland in front of it, which was really an odd thing to see in England at the time. I think there's something to the idea that some of the members of the IRA adopted Marxist ideology. They do admire Cuban Revolution, and especially at that time. So I could see maybe that was the attraction for her to do so. But once her boyfriend, Walter Heaton, went to jail and she was released with a suspended sentence, she went immediately to Ireland, took up with a rogue IRA soldier, and really stepped up her game in terms of violence and direct action.
This violence includes at some point an attack on, what, a police station?
Yes, and it really is a remarkable story. She and her boyfriend at the time, Eddie Gallagher, and a couple of other rogue IRA fighters, without permission from IRA leadership, hijacked a helicopter and filled it with milk churns packed with explosives. Rose worked on these herself. And they flew over a Royal Ulster police station, a barracks, and attempted to drop these bombs on the police station and missed their target. But it was the first aerial attack in history, terrorist attack of its sort. It was the first aerial attack on British possessions since the Second World War. So it was a really bold and remarkable, though failed, effort.
Now, I want to just backtrack a little bit here, because I understand that her life of crime goes back to, at some point, stealing from her parents. And I'm not talking about as a 6-year-old or an 8-year-old, but as somebody grown, she goes back to her childhood home and commits some kind of a theft there.
Remarkable story, because despite the fact that she abandoned her family and told them, though she loved them, she hates everything they stand for, her family never abandoned her and kept supplying her with money. However, she spent more than she could take in, which was a significant amount, on people in her area and on her boyfriend, Walter Heaton. Ultimately, they ran out of money, and she turned to the source she knew best, which was her family. And while her family was off at what's best described as England's version of the Kentucky Derby, she went with a couple of other men to her home, broke in, and stole a bunch of art and antiques to sell them. It was about $125,000 worth at the time. So it was it's a major heist, and it's the first time a woman had really pulled off an art heist. But of course, it wouldn't be her last.
And was this particular heist to make a statement, or was that to try to somehow monetize it?
Strictly for money. It was a heist done because she needed money. She and Walter needed money to continue their activities, and this was the place that she knew best to get it from.
Well, we're gradually working our way to the story of the heist of this beautiful painting by Vermeer, and we'll get to it in just a moment here. Time for a short break on our program. We're visiting with Anthony Amore. He is the Director of Security and Chief Investigator at the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum, and he's author of The Woman Who Stole Vermeer, The True Story of Rose Dugdale and the Rustboro House Heist. Stay tuned. I'm Marcus Smith. You're listening to Constant Wonder. It's a great pleasure to have with us Anthony Amore. He is author of The Woman Who Stole Vermeer, The True Story of Rose Dugdale and the Rustboro House Heist. Anthony Amore, we've gotten to know a little bit about Rose Dugdale, her background, her political leanings. She's already getting involved in violent activities associated with the IRA. Let's go now to that year, 1974, and the heist that's in the subtitle of the book, or implied in the main title, too. 1974, where is this painting? Why does she go about this particular crime?
Well, in 1974, the painting by Vermeer, Lady Writing a Letter with Her Maid, is hanging in the Rustboro House in County Wicklow in Ireland. And the house is owned by an extremely rich man and his wife, Sir Alfred Bite, and his wife, Lady Clementine Bite. And they seem to be very nice people. They just have enormous wealth. They're heirs of a diamond fortune. And Rose, in April of 1974, decides to mastermind a heist of a number of paintings, 19 in total, from the Rustboro House. And her motive, bringing up the name Dolores Price, was that Price and her sister Marion and a few other people were incarcerated in Great Britain for a major bombing campaign they waged in 1973 in London, with the most significant being a car bomb that injured hundreds of people at the Old Bailey courthouse, the famous Old Bailey. The Price sisters and their confederates were arrested immediately on their way to the airport and imprisoned. And the Price sisters insisted that they be treated as prisoners of war and not as criminals. The British government refused. So the Price sisters went on a hunger strike, and it became worldwide news. And to counter the hunger strike, eventually the British government force-fed them, which became even bigger news. And it's just an absolutely brutal method that I spell out in the book. So Rose decided that if she could steal these paintings, she could hold them for ransom to demand that the government send the Price sisters to Northern Ireland to serve their sentences as political prisoners.
Yeah, this is somebody who's thinking it through. And how do you characterize her her analysis of the situation? I mean, you're a specialist in these kinds of things that happen with these kinds of art crimes. And I mean, did she have even a chance of prevailing upon people and getting her way? I mean, this just seems far-fetched, and yet she seems fairly intelligent.
You know, that's a great point. She is very intelligent. She's a PhD in philosophy, and she's much better at stealing things. So she's a much better criminal than she is a tactician, because what happens is she steals the painting successfully, but the commission of the crime shows the authorities exactly who was behind it. By including herself, the police were already looking for her. And during the crime, she and her colleagues calling the victims capitalist pigs over and over, it became clear who was most likely behind the theft. So the police were onto her right away. Further, she believed that these paintings could help her get the Price sisters moved, which she could not anticipate with two things. First, she did this without IRA permission, and the IRA were actually very good at strategy. They did what they did using really well-planned-out strategies for trying to get action from the British government. Secondly, when Rose stole this from Mayer, she did not anticipate that the Price sisters would tell the media through their father that they wanted the painting given back. They did not want to be moved to Northern Ireland on the backs of other people's losses or this way. They wanted to be moved back to Northern Ireland on principle, not as a ransom. So her plan, though well-intended for the Price sisters, was unwelcome.
Who actually committed it? We talk about this being Rose's heist, but was she hands-on?
She was hands-on, which is really remarkable and unprecedented, and you can tell by the paintings that she stole. She was inside the house. She was the ruse through which they entered the home, and she pointed out to the thugs that she brought with her which paintings to take. The house is populated with lots of art and antiques. Only Rose amongst the thieves would know a Vermeer from a paint-by-numbers painting. As I mentioned to the press last week, many people might be able to pick out a Rembrandt or a Vermeer or such a great artist's works, but not everyone could pick out a Van de Velde the way she did. So you have to picture a woman in 1974 going through this mansion, this monstrous mansion, pointing out the paintings for the thieves to take. It was really unprecedented, and even to this day, it's never happened again.
So here's a couple of burning questions for you. These always come to my mind whenever I hear about these art heists. The first and most obvious one is, were they all recovered? And the second one is, how much damage did they sustain because of this?
They were all recovered rather quickly. The Rose's plan was that they would go to a cottage out in a lesser populated area in Ireland, and she didn't understand that that would just draw more attention to her rather than less. So she was caught rather quickly. The paintings were not damaged. There was a slight scuff on one of the paintings, easily repaired. So no harm came to the paintings, but it's just a theft that was so large in scale that it was the biggest one to its time. And led to further thefts from the Rusborough House. In fact, the Rusborough House was robbed three more times after Rose Dugdale made it a target in the minds of criminals.
So no cracking of the oils of the paints and no cutting of the canvas. They just lifted the whole frames off and took them all together?
They left almost all of the frames in place. And usually thieves do that because they just make them more cumbersome. So they took the paintings on their stretchers from the frames. And the paintings are pretty resilient. So there was a scuff, I believe, on the Vermeer that was fixed. And the rest were fine. You know, anytime a painting is stolen, conservators go to work to make sure it's still stable. And these were examined very closely at the National Gallery in Ireland and soon returned to Sir Alfred Beit.
This is kind of going down a little bit of a rabbit hole, but personally, when I think about the value, the cultural value of these masterpieces and my concern for their well-being, you know, it's almost like you're concerned about a person having been kidnapped, and what's the lingering cost to the individual? I've almost personified the paintings that get stolen, and I'm wondering if because they're these high profile artworks, if that story somehow doesn't upstage the political story of what Rose was trying to do. In the end, when people remember this in history and look back at these heists, they're going to be focused on the artwork still, right?
Precisely. That's an excellent point. One of my motives for writing the book is that in the decades following this theft, Rose's story got lost because most people just thought of it as an art heist, and it's much more than that. And I think you nailed it on the head there. People remember the art theft. Very few people remember the cause. And in fact, when I was working on the book and I was doing research and spoke to people, nobody remembered what her cause was. And I think it's a fascinating story, and Dolores Price's story is remarkable in itself. So you're right, and I hope this book does a service in reminding people that this was a really unique, singular-type heist with a political motive.
So let's go now the story after the heist, after she is caught. She does time?
She does time, and interestingly, she's the only one that does time. She doesn't turn in her aiders and abettors in this theft. She goes to prison alone. Her boyfriend, Eddie Gallagher, is on the run. She doesn't name him. Neither does she name the other two men who went in with her. Soon after she is imprisoned, she sneaks. It's just remarkable. She sneaks a sample of her urine to her attorney, who has it tested and finds that she's pregnant. And the Irish government didn't know quite what to do. They couldn't release her, but no one had ever given birth in prison before. But this time they made an exception, and they brought a makeshift hospital to her in her prison cell, and she gave birth in prison to a son.
Yeah, imagine being that kid and growing up. And, you're not in contact with him, are you?
I am. He's a remarkably nice young man and well-adjusted and incredibly likable.
This story just keeps going on and on and on. And we're probably going to have to figure out, though, if she learned anything from this, if the correctional approach of incarceration changed or swayed her, or is she did she remain resolute to her cause?
Absolutely resolute. She went on her own hunger strike for demands that she was making in the prison. Soon thereafter, Eddie Gallagher, who was still free, took hostage a leading industrialist in Ireland at the time and held him for 36 days, demanding that the mother of his child be released from prison. Ultimately, he's forced to give up. He's imprisoned himself, and then the state decides that the two should be allowed to marry, and they marry in prison. It's just, as you said, well, it's a story that just keeps on going.
Well, okay, from her perspective, I mean, from my perspective, she's engaging in, you know, this is that classic situation of one person will say this is a freedom fighter, the other person will say this is a terrorist. She fits in this category, right?
Perfectly.
Yeah. And so from her perspective, she sees herself as what, kind of a Joan of Arc figure?
Absolutely, as a freedom fighter. As a revolutionary, Walter Heaton, her first boyfriend, who was imprisoned in England, is still alive, and I've spoken to him frequently, and he still maintains that he's a revolutionary. I don't think that it's fair to call them terrorists because, by the definition of terrorism, they weren't random acts of violence against civilians to achieve political goals, except they did strike Sir Alfred Beatty in the head with the butt of a gun. But their motives were plainly political and revolutionary at the time. And I'm not excusing her because I think her crimes were abhorrent. And frankly, if her helicopter attack had succeeded, she would have killed hundreds of people. So I don't think in any way she's a hero. But I do think that she was ardently committed to the cause of revolution and freedom for the Irish people.
And she has made statements in the course of her life, I don't know how recently, probably way back in the 70s, but she's made statements that are kind of along the lines of the ends justify the means, and if people have to be killed, aw shucks.
Completely Machiavellian, without a doubt. She's made it clear that she resolved that if she had to kill people, she would have. And I guess in that respect, you can start to say, well, maybe she was a terrorist. So it's something that only the reader can decide for themselves.
Now, the story of Northern Ireland and Ireland, the IRA, Sinn Féin, the entire thing, when I was growing up, that was such a hotbed. And I would imagine there are still glowing embers here and there. But the story has subsided for the most part in recent years. Am I not right there?
Yes, it's not the way it was in the 1970s and 80s and 90s. There's a newer group of people that call themselves the IRA. They're much more violent. They much more resemble youth gangs than an actual army, which is what it was in its heyday in the 70s. But the Dolores Price, her life ends dissatisfied with the way the Good Friday Peace Accords ended. She was disillusioned with the IRA, completely disillusioned with Gerry Adams and the peace process, and went to her grave saying that this was not the cause that she had fought for.
The reason I bring this up, this political aftermath, is because I'm wondering if I were to try to get into Rose Dugdale's mind today, if she would feel that her aims were partially met, that her revolutionary philosophy was justified by some results she actually helped to arrive at?
I would believe so. She, one of the great missions was for her to be accepted by the IRA. And the interesting dichotomy is that Dolores Price, who was in the IRA, went to her grave opposed to Gerry Adams. And in her senior years, now in a wheelchair, Rose can be seen at parades with Gerry Adams. So she's part of that IRA Sinn Féin establishment. She helped lead the education efforts of Sinn Féin and is accepted by the Irish people now late in her life.
You know, in conclusion here, I'm going to drop the story of Rose Dugdale per se and just kind of back out and look at this very broadly with museums and pieces of art and the theft of masterpieces for whatever reason. And then I'm thinking of the thankless task of the people guarding these collections. And you're very well acquainted with who these people are and what their work is like, what they have to do on a day-to-day basis. And I just can't imagine being a museum guard and having what can seem to be just a real dull walk every night. And yet then these things happen, these really big heists. And suddenly where you are is the focal point of the whole world. That's just bizarre too.
It is. And here at the Gardner Museum, where the biggest heist of anything ever took place in 1990, I constantly remind the guards that here in this building, a museum security guard made a mistake and let thieves in. He broke policy and protocol, and thieves came in. And in that instance, with just one mistake, a dull job turned into a security guard who will go down in infamy because of an error. And I remind my guards, you don't want to be that person. You have to stay alert.
Anthony Amore, what a story, and such a pleasure to have a chance to visit with you. Thank you so much for being with us today.
It's my great pleasure. Thank you.
Anthony Amore with us. He is Director of Security and Chief Investigator at the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum. And there he has the task of overseeing ongoing efforts to recover 13 works of stolen art from that museum back in 1990, as he was just talking about. His third book is titled The Woman Who Stole Vermeer, The True Story of Rose Dugdale and the Rusborough House Heist.
After a short break, Constant Wonder will return for more on art theft from the perspective of a leading FBI expert on the subject. Stay with us. Welcome back to Constant Wonder. I'm Tenery Taylor. Art theft is a bit like piracy. There's a glamour we attach to it and a kind of weird sense that it's a victimless crime because the victims are posh and everyone wears suits. At some level, of course, we know that's all nonsense. And no one knows that better than my next guest. Robert Whitman is former senior investigator and founder of the FBI's National Art Crime Team. Over the course of his career, Whitman recovered over $300 million worth of art and artifacts. He's author of the best-selling book Priceless, How I Went Undercover to Rescue the World's Stolen Treasures. And he also now brings his expertise to the private sector through his Robert Whitman Incorporated Art Security Consulting Firm. Welcome to Constant Wonder.
Hi, Tenery. It's great to be here.
So I have to ask, is most art theft like the movies?
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting. When you see the movies and you watch Pierce Brosnan in his fabulous movie, and you also watched George Clooney in those casino movies, it's the criminal who is the suave, debonair guy who's actually doing these heists and planning these things. But when it came to the reality, it was the undercover agents for law enforcement who played those roles, because the thieves were generally just thieves. They were doing all types of crimes. They weren't specifically art thefts, but they were doing armed robbery and murder and aggravated assault, but they just happened to steal from a museum as well. But they never could sell the material. The hardest part in an art heist, it's not the stealing, it's the selling. The suave, debonair individuals were the undercover law enforcement officers who were going in as the art dealers who were trying to buy the stolen art.
People like you.
Right. That was my role.
So it almost sounds like there aren't professional criminal art thieves. They're more – that's just one of many things that they're involved in.
Yeah. Throughout the years, through the investigations that we did at the FBI and since then, generally speaking, we saw individuals who were involved in criminal enterprises and organizations, so they would happen to do an art heist. Now, there are specific individuals once in a while who do go out. Usually they're collectors or they're experts who go in, and they basically have this mentality that they have to own these pieces. And they'll go in and steal them, but usually it's a type of thing where it's a smash and grab, or it's basically a shoplifting type of situation. It's not these, planned out art heists that you see in the movies.
Are they obsessed with a particular piece of art?
They are. They are obsessed with owning that specific type of art that they've studied, that they've looked at over the years, that they've become expert in. And usually they're easier to catch. And the reason for that is because, you have records of who goes in, who is involved, who has access to the artifacts. 90% of art heists in museums and cultural property heists in museums are by insiders. And when we say insiders, we mean people who have access to the collections, experts, curators, even maintenance people who are there working, or even guards. I've had cases where guards stole things. So usually when that's the situation, it's easier to catch those individuals because you have a group. You have someone that you can look at. The tough ones are the groups who come in from outside, who do burglaries and robberies, who have no connection to the museum or to the historic home. Those are the tough ones because you don't know who they are.
But those are far less common, it sounds like.
Far less common, yeah. You have very, very few of those, and especially in the United States. We've had maybe two or three actual armed robberies of museums in the past 25 years. It just doesn't happen. Hmm. Now, in Europe, it's a whole different story. Europe gets robbed quite often, and it's because of the number of museums and historic houses, the age of the security systems, because of the fact that these old castles and whatnot, very difficult to secure them, the lack of law enforcement security in the museums themselves, and the easy access of criminals to go between countries because of the Schengen or European Union status. You know, there's no borders. So basically they can go from one country to the next, not be stopped, and take the artwork with them.
Mm. Well, let's talk about it. Then who buys the stolen artwork? You know, you kind of referred to this that it's I mean, who's going to buy a Rembrandt?
Yeah, right. Well, I've bought a few as an FBI agent. And that's what happens. The real art in an art heist isn't the stealing; it's the selling. And these criminals are better thieves than they are businessmen because they really don't have access to markets to sell this material. You know, what makes art unique and expensive is, number one, that it's unique. Number two, it's authentic. And number three, the good title. And if you don't have a good title because you have stolen property, you really don't have anything. You don't own anything of value.
So you're talking about provenance, because when a museum goes to buy something, they want to know where it's been and whose collection and all that kind of thing, right?
No, well, provenance is one-third of the stool. In other words, it's a three-legged stool. Authenticity and provenance is one, but the other is to have good title. You have to have ownership of the painting. You have to be able to prove that.
Ah, I see what you're saying. Mm-hmm.
It's like if it's to bring it down home, if you buy a car and the person sells you a stolen car, you don't own the car. The person who you know had it stolen from them, they're the ones who still own that car.
Right.
Well, it just passes right through to $1 million artwork. If it's stolen, you can't pass good title, which means that you don't own anything. So buyers have to beware. To make sure that whatever they're buying, they might not knowingly buy stolen work, but if they get something that was stolen from a museum 50 years ago, basically they don't own anything. And if it comes to light, that'll be recovered and they'll be stuck.
But certainly they must be able to sell it to people. I mean, when you were undercover, you must have looked like a likely buyer. And so who is the likely buyer of a multi-million dollar painting?
You know, very few. I don't know of any people who have the ability to be able to pay that kind of money for these artworks. They don't want stolen property. Auction houses don't want stolen property. It's just nothing but headaches for them. I've done cases where I offered $250,000 for a $30 million Rembrandt. I've had cases where I've offered $10 million for $65 million worth of stolen art. And, you know, we always had the money to show. But in reality, there's nobody out there who wants to pay $10 million for stolen art because if you get caught with it, you can go to prison.
So do the thieves end up just kind of selling it at a fraction, just a tiny portion of the value?
Well, as I said, the $30 million Rembrandt, they were trying to sell it to me for $250,000.
Wow. Mm-hmm.
So they're trying to make whatever they can is what they're trying to do. But the problem is, even at $250,000, that's still a lot of money for someone to pay for something that's stolen. Because in the end, they don't have good title.
Mm-hmm.
So they lose the piece, at some point, and it's still a lot of money to lose.
When we're talking about art crime, obviously Ocean's 11, these exciting heists come to mind. But is there more to art crimes than just stealing paintings?
Sure. Yeah. You know, at the FBI, they talked about cultural property protection. And throughout my career, I had many cases involving artwork, sculptures, that type of thing. But then again, there was a case where I was able to go undercover and recover a stolen copy of the Bill of Rights, the United States Bill of Rights. It was stolen in 1865 by a Union trooper who was coming back with Sherman's troops from Atlanta. And as they came up the coast, they stopped in North Carolina and took the capital, Raleigh. Well, this trooper went into the state house there and took the actual copy of the Bill of Rights that was sent to the state of North Carolina in 1789 by George Washington. So he took it with him. He basically took it right out of the state house, kept it, sold it. It was being offered to the National Constitution Center in Philadelphia for several million dollars. And so because it was stolen from the people in North Carolina, of course, it's stolen property. We went undercover as philanthropists to buy it. And we're able to recover that for the state of North Carolina. So you can see it's not an artwork, but it's a cultural artifact that has a lot of importance, that means a lot to the people.
Sure. Did the FBI ever get involved in, like, forgeries or fraud where people were trying to pass off something as something that it's not?
Oh, yeah. I'd say, the entire industry, the criminal enterprise of art and artifacts and whatnot, prints, is about a $6 billion, that's the estimate, $6 billion industry worldwide. The whole art market, the legitimate market, is a $200 billion industry. But of that, the $6 billion is the illicit cultural property market. And I think about 80% of that is frauds, forgeries, and fakes. It's not theft. Mm. It's people offering frauds, forgeries, and fakes. The reason for that is because the value of the art market has grown exponentially in the past 30 years. And so, you know, Willie Sutton, who was a bank robber, who purportedly was asked by a reporter, why do you rob banks? And he said, because that's where the money is. Well, in today's world, the money's in the art market.
Mm. Bob, I'd like to talk a little bit about your own career. Did you always want to be an FBI agent?
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, when I was very young, I used to watch a television show called The FBI Story. Some of your listeners might remember that. Depends on how old they are. I don't want to show my age, but that was back in the 60s. And watching that show, I was very interested because my parents were – my mother was from Japan, and she had married my dad. She met him on a Air Force base in Japan during the Korean War. And I was literally actually born there in 1955. So I was from there. So, but there was a lot of time. There was a lot of tension between, you know, the Japanese that were in the United States and what was going on. I was pretty close to being after the Second World War. So watching the FBI story, there was a lot of emphasis on things like civil rights and all. And I thought that would be a great career to be involved with. And so I was interested in from a very young age.
Mm-hmm. And art crime, was that always something you were fascinated by, or did you kind of stumble into that?
Well, you know, here's how it worked out. I went to Philadelphia in 1988 as an FBI agent. That was my first office. And I was put onto a truck hijacking squad, which basically is a property crime squad. And the first cases I was assigned in the office were two heists from museums in Philadelphia. One was at the University of Pennsylvania Museum of Archaeology and Anthropology, and the second was from the Rodin Museum. Well, we were able to basically solve both cases. You know, working with agents and working with the police, we solved both cases. And at that point, I realized that I was interested in it. And having been brought up in the antiques business, my dad and mom were in the antiques business, Asian antiques, I kind of had a background in it. So, you know, this is the interesting thing. When it comes to investigating art crime, it's not knowing about art history that's important. It's knowing how to do a business in the art world. So it's all about the business of art, not the history.
Huh. So I'm really interested in how you kind of approach an art case maybe differently than another case. Because you went in the introduction, we were talking about Ocean's 11. You said, well, actually, it's the undercover agents who are the suave ones. And so, you know, how do you go about setting up an alias? And are you making things up on the fly, or is it a long process to even get started?
Well, you know, there's an entire program at the FBI called the Undercover Program and Undercover Operations. And what happens there is they do have backstopping for agents. So basically, you do have a nom de plume or a fake name and background information. But each person has to adapt what they do to their own strengths and weaknesses. So, you know, in the art world, you wouldn't necessarily dress as a biker, so to speak,
right,
and try to infiltrate a group of galleries that are doing forgeries, you know, whereas you probably wouldn't dress in a suit and tie or a tuxedo and go and try to infiltrate a biker's gang, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
It all depends on what your target is. So, yeah, all that comes with training and background.
And I would imagine it'd be hard to this sounds like it would be, you know, if you're dressing up, you might have – you know, be at a dinner where alcohol is being served. And I mean, this is not just specific to undercover agents in the art world, but are you allowed to drink alcohol while you're undercover? Is that risky? I would think so.
Well, you do what you have to do. In my case, what I would do is I normally wouldn't take drugs or drink alcohol. And the reason I would come up with explanations for that. But everybody has their own way of getting around it. You know, I would say something like, look, if I start drinking right now, I'll wake up in Cleveland 2 weeks from now. So we don't want to do that if you want to do a deal.
Mm.
You know, that type of thing.
Yeah,
so you'd always come up with some type of excuse as to why you couldn't do something. And generally speaking, if it was plausible and if it was humanistic, people would go along with it.
And I understand you always went by Bob.
Always, yeah. Well, that's one of the primary directives is you always use your first real name or your real first name because in case somebody sees you and calls you.
Oh, yeah. I wonder if you'd tell us a story where once you you claimed to be a lawyer and your contact that you were working with trying to snag actually looked you up.
Yeah. I was undercover in an operation to try to recover a golden piece of body armor. This golden body armor was 2,000 years old. It was recovered out of, it was actually stolen from a tomb in Peru. So it's the largest piece of gold ever found in an archaeological site in a tomb in the Americas. And this piece had been underground in Peru for a number of years. And finally, it started to surface, so I was undercover as a buyer of ancient gold. And the people who were trying to sell it were meeting with me, and they asked me, you know, how do you know about this, and why are you involved in this? And one of the things I said to them was I was an attorney, and I had clients who were interested in buying this type of gold. So one of the individuals went back, and he started looking through the New Jersey State Bar. They thought I was from New Jersey at the time. And they started going through the bar records, and they couldn't find my name. So they confronted me with that. Mm-hmm. And of course, I had to think fast. I said, well, I was disbarred because of domestic violence. And the first thing they said was, oh, I mean, people, you know, that's one of those things that's abhorrent, mm-hmm. and people do not discuss. Mm-hmm. So as a result, he accepted that as why I wasn't in the roles. But those are the types of things that you come into. You have to think fast and basically bring things to a human level. And when you do that, you know, people follow along.
You're listening to Constant Wonder. I'm Tenery Taylor, and we have with us today Robert Whitman. He is the author of Priceless, How I Went Undercover to Rescue the World's Stolen Treasures, also the founder of the FBI's National Art Crime Team. Robert Whitman, I just want to ask you, what's the most valuable piece of art that you ever recovered?
Well, Tenery, it's interesting. To look at it, there's two ways of looking at valuable. One is financially, and another one's culturally. And I can tell you the most financially valuable single piece when it comes to artwork was a Rembrandt self-portrait that was stolen in an armed robbery at the Swedish National Museum in Stockholm.
Hmm.
We went undercover in Copenhagen, Denmark, and were able to recover that. It was valued at $35 million. So you can see how the value of it was very high. And in fact, it's an important case because three countries worked together, Sweden, Denmark, and the United States, to recover that because it was a piece of cultural history, you know, the importance of a Rembrandt self-portrait. But then again, you know, from a cultural standpoint, another case I had involved a battle flag. It was the 12th Regiment Corps d'Afrique. It was a battle flag that was carried by one of the very first African-American regiments in the Civil War. And in that situation, these 500 African-American soldiers, Union soldiers, went into battle at the Battle of Port Hudson in Louisiana. And five individuals were shot out from under that flag, carrying that flag in battle. And that was so important. And that was valued at about $35,000. It was stolen from the Army in the late 1970s, and we did an undercover operation to recover that. So you can see the value financially were incredibly different, $35 million to $35,000. But the cultural history of that battle flag, where these individuals were fighting for their freedom and the freedom of their children for all time,
mm-hmm.
for the first time in their lives, it just shows the difference in the value of the cultural history of that. So both are the same.
Mm-hmm. And then the biggest case, I mentioned that we were going to talk about the biggest case you ever worked on with 13 pieces stolen from a Boston museum.
Yeah. That's the Isabella Stewart Gardner Museum. The 13 pieces were taken in 1990 on St. Patrick's Day night. Two individuals dressed as Boston police officers. They went in, they tricked the two guards. They told one of the guards that there was an arrest warrant, a fugitive warrant for one of them. So the guards allowed them to come in and talk to them. As a result, of course, they weren't police officers, they were thieves. They took those two guards and they tied them up to pipes in the basement. And then they went around the museum for over an hour stealing these 13 objects of art. One of them was a Rembrandt self-portrait called The Storm Over the Sea of Galilee. The only self-portrait, I would say seascape. It was the only seascape that Rembrandt ever did. A second piece was a Vermeer, one of the only missing Vermeer in the world. It was called The Concert. It's considered a masterpiece. The total value of the heist that night, Henry, was $300 million.
Wow.
Today, the paintings have not been recovered 30 years later and are valued at over $500 million. So the FBI, the museum, the whole world is still searching for those 13 artworks. Today, there's a $10 million reward for recovery of the artworks. So if any of your listeners know where they're at, they should call us.
You got that out there? So tell me a little bit, did you even get close to finding the thieves, or did you have any leads?
Well, the FBI's been looking at leads for, as I say, for 30 years. When I was at the FBI from 2005 to 2008, during that period of time, I was undercover working on that case. We had leads out of Miami that led us to investigations in Paris, Marseille, and Barcelona. We did recover two Picassos that were stolen from the granddaughter, Diana. It was from her apartment, worth about $65 million. We also recovered four paintings that were stolen from the Museum of Fine Arts in Nice, a Sicily, two Bruegels, and a Monet. But we did not get the Gardner paintings. It didn't work out for that. But we recovered all the rest. The total value of that was about $75 million worth we got back. But as a result, you know, the paintings went back underground, and we were able to get those back, the Gardner pieces. So it was about a three-year undercover operation, and as I say, Marseille, Paris, Barcelona, Miami. It was just awful. But, you know, somebody has to do that tough stuff.
And this one was a little more dangerous than, you know, dealing with kind of criminals who decide to snag art, right? I mean, didn't you kind of get in with some mob characters and have to carry a gun? And the stakes were a lot higher, right, with this ring?
Sure. Well, as I said earlier, though, you know, these criminal enterprises, these organized crime groups, they're all involved in other types of crimes. So it's the theory that art theft is less dangerous is not true. Any art theft, any kind of theft is a crime, and you're going to be taking people's freedom away. So as a result, many times they're going to fight for it. So you're always ready for that situation. And many times I was involved in cases, people had guns, because that's what they used. So, but this one was particularly dangerous because these individuals were known to be, you know, killers. But that's the job of a law enforcement agent. Anybody in law enforcement faces that every day, so you just accept that as part of the job.
Robert K. Whitman is a former senior investigator and founder of the FBI's National Art Crime Team. He's also the author of Priceless, How I Went Undercover to Rescue the World's Stolen Treasures. When we come back from a short break, we'll explore the human brain. You might think that its purpose is just that, thinking. But not so, argues the author of 7.5 Lessons About the Brain. Don't be late to this class, Brain Lessons, coming up when Constant Wonder returns.